You're listening to Kingdom, Empire and Plus Ultra, Conversations on the History of Portugal and Spain, 1415 to 1898, a podcast series brought to you by UCD School of History and historyhub.ie. We're speaking today with Professor Tamar Herzog. Professor Herzog is Monroe Guttmann Professor of Latin American Affairs at Harvard University. She received her PhD at the EHESS in Paris in 1994, which focused on the administration of criminal justice in Quito in the early modern period. A legal scholar and historian by training, her work engages with early modern European history, colonial Latin American history, imperial history, and Atlantic and legal history. It centres on the relationship between Spain, Portugal, Portuguese and Spanish America, and the ways by which Iberian societies changed as a result of their involvement in the colonial project. Among her publications are Frontiers of Possession, Spain and Portugal in Europe and the Americas, published in 2015, Upholding Justice, State Law and the Penal System in Quito, published in 2004, and Defining Nations, Immigrants and Citizens in Early Modern Spain and Spanish America, published in 2003. Forthcoming from Harvard University Press is her work, A Short History of European Law, The Last 2.5 Millennia. She is the recipient of several scholarships and awards, including most recently the James A. Rawley Prize for Best Book in Atlantic History, awarded by the American Historical Association in 2016 for her most recent work, Frontiers of Possession. She was also named Walter Channing Cabot Fellow in 2016, also in recognition of her most recent work. Professor Herzog, Tamar, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
You're very welcome. And we are, in fact, speaking about your most recent publication, Frontiers of Possession, today. Which examines how territorial borders were established in Europe and the Americas during the early modern period, and challenges the view that national boundaries are determined mainly by military conflicts and treaties. Rather than a political, military or diplomatic history, it analyses how boundaries were formed on the ground by neighbours and how the right to land and the use of territory were discussed, negotiated, obtained or denied. So I suppose the most obvious question to begin with is to ask why you wrote this book. What do you think is missing from the current historiography?
Yes, so I think this book, like most of my books, began with a fascination with present-day phenomena. And one of them is this political importance of a discourse that suggests that there are historical rights to land, that some people have right to land either because they as a group used to live on this land that was taken away, or that they should continue holding to the land because it was yours in the, theirs in the past. It's of course a very powerful discourse that makes claims in the present by relying on what had happened in the past. And I, as a historian and a jurist, always found it very, very puzzling. First, because it assumes a certain continuity between present and past. It assumes that whatever a group had in the past should continue in the present, assuming that the group is the same, but also assuming in general continuity between past and present. When, as a historian, I was always trained that histories change over time. So I was trained not to think that the past can be part of the present. In fact, I was trained to think about the past as a foreign land, as we used to think about it as anthropological, to look at the past. But the second thing that really amazed me about this idea of historical rights to land is the idea that the past was clear. So people who discuss their entitlement today assumed that if they could return to a certain past, and of course they could discuss forever when exactly is the right time to go back to, which time is relevant, but they still think that somewhere in the past, their entitlements were clear, as if the present is conflictual, but the past is not, which also, as a historian, I found extremely disturbing because I know it's not true. I think if we have conflict in the present, we had conflicts in the past too. So I always thought it was an amazing how powerful this discourse was and how little historians have engaged with it to say something that was perhaps more historically thoughtful and correct about this discourse. But what I also found amazing is not only this idea of historical right to land, but also the idea that states were the bearers of rights, states were the main actors in the past. The territory was determined by kings and states. by diplomatic arrangements, which again I found is quite anachronistic because it transposes our idea of the overpowering efficient state of the present to a past when it did not exist. And then the third thing that really amazed me about this discourse is the idea that while territory changes over time, communities do not. And as if debates about territory involved lands, but did not involve identifying people, whereby as a historian, but also I was doing research in Quito, Ecuador in 1995, when the last war between Ecuador and Peru, the territorial conflict broke up. And it was very clear that they were also discussing the adhesion of people, that they were trying to wonder whether the indigenous, the native people living in the frontier should be classified as Peruvian or Ecuadorian. So I came to think that rather than communities acquiring territory, the process of territorial acquisition involved both searching for land and acquiring land, but also actually defining the community and the members. So I looked to the bibliography to see what answers have been given to these questions, and I really found none. The bibliography, and now I'm talking, while the questions I had in mind were very general and not particular to Spain and Portugal. In the bibliography on Spain and Portugal and the overseas domains, the general assumption was, in fact, that treaties determined the border between these countries, both in Europe and the Americas, and people always make reference to the Treaty of Tordesillas, 1494, the Treaty of Madrid, 1750 in the Americas, though other treaties existed as well and were relevant. And in the Iberian Peninsula, they're talking about Alcañices, 1297, as the treaty to define the border between Spain and Portugal in the Americas. These historians look to the work of kings, diplomats, sometimes war, but that's how they tell the story of the territorial formation of these countries. As a result, it seemed to me that this historiography didn't ask first, how are treaties implemented? Even if you agree in abstract about a certain border, what happens on the ground when you come to concretize it? Especially in a period like the medieval and early modern period, where knowledge of the territory, mapping, and so forth was so deficient. This bibliography didn't think at all or didn't consider how people thought about the right to land, how they imagined why the land was theirs, how they made claims to the land, which is where the question of possession and Roman law doctrine of possession come in. And I found it really interesting that although one can think that law is some superstructure that people don't interact with in everyday life, in fact, the people I investigated, who were often illiterate farmers, knew much more about their entitlements than what we would imagine. The historiography didn't compare what happened on one side of the ocean to the other, as if the conflict between Spain and Portugal in Europe had nothing to do with the conflict in the Americas and vice versa. And they tended always to think, like very often happens in the colonial literature, of the colonies as chaotic, as unnatural, as artificial, whereby Europe is natural and ordered, which I thought was really strange. In the American case, the role of the indigenous in determining the border between Spain and Portugal wasn't considered at all, because the way it was presented was as if Europeans were fighting against one another and they were fighting against the indigenous. But these two struggles were not linked in the way I thought they should be linked, because I believed that one struggle and the other, since they happened on the same territory in the same time, actually affected one another. There was absolutely no interest in the long durée of how these conflicts developed, how they were managed, how they were resolved, and how they affected the lives of individuals, what it made them do, what it didn't make them do. So I wanted to look at all these things by actually looking at thousands of interactions between individuals and communities over issues of usage right, possession, jurisdiction, ownership. And I wasn't interested so much about what happened in the courts and diplomats, but I was looking at these individuals who lived in the territory and who had to discuss their right to land as they performed daily tasks, such as letting their cattle pasture, cultivating the land, collecting taxes, or trying to convert natives. And I noticed that sometimes these activities went uncontested, but in other times they led to conflict. So I wanted to understand why conflict emerged, what people argued when there was a conflict, how these conflicts modified what they did, and as well as what were the results. So that's the book.
Wonderful. You challenged the traditional narrative that territorial formation of Spain and Portugal in Europe and in America was enacted through treaties and military conflict. And you say that it was, in fact, a much more complicated series of localized processes that determined the establishment of frontiers. And you also go against the grain of traditional Iberian narratives by examining the establishment of frontiers in America first, before examining similar processes in Spain and Portugal. Why did you choose this structure?
So I think for me, the reason to put the Americas first is really to break this idea of that I mentioned before, of the colonies as being exceptional, chaotic, unnatural, perhaps even illegal. You know, Carl Schmitt is known to attribute all these things to the colonies, but many people do. The literature usually talks about natural borders in Europe and kind of artificial, because implemented from the outside, borders in the colonies. And I really didn't see it happening. What I saw in the colonies were the same type of dynamics that in Europe, of local actors trying to survive or improve their living conditions. And as they were doing so, they were acquiring territories for their community and state. So I didn't see the big difference between the two of them. So I thought that by inversing the narrative and starting with the colonies, we might break this theoretical opposition between colonies and Europe. I'm not saying that the colonies were the same as Europe. And in fact, in the book, I do mention how they differed. But I do think that the kind of meta-narrative we always have, in which we begin by Europe, then go to the colonies and basically forget about what continued to happen in Europe, really sets us up not to think about what was the relationship between the colonial experience and Europe and how they both affected one another. So my sense, and this is true for my previous work, in my previous book on citizenship and immigration, defining nations, I was trying to do the same thing. I was trying to look to both sides of the ocean, not so much in order to compare them as much as to use one in order to understand the other. Because I think that some things that somehow the documentation makes clearer in one place, the documentation is much more silenced about in the other place. And in the case of territorial formation, particularly in the colonies, everything happens very fast. The territories are huge. In Europe, the territory is much smaller and things really develop much slower. So it allows you to see different things. It's like fast forwarding a movie or slow motion a movie. So that's why I wanted to have both. And in fact, in the book, I treat each differently. In the Americas, I describe actors' interests and arguments, whereby in Europe, I look with a kind of very closely at particular micro-historical, almost analysis of particular conflicts, just because the type of conflict was so different that it really required a different type of methodology to analyze and look at them.
You also mentioned that there were two methods by which Spanish and Portuguese protagonists could determine ownership of territory in America, through formal documents and treaties, and also through legal doctrines of possession, which originated in Roman law. Can you elaborate on this?
Yes. So when I looked at what people actually argued when they saw their neighbors doing something and they told them, "You can't do that, because the land is mine." So they, let's say the Spaniards caught a Portuguese collecting wood and said to this Portuguese, "You cannot do that because this is our territory, not yours, and only we have here the right." Usually the type of argument that these people would invoke was either the agreements between communities, formal documents, or they would invoke use and possession, which sends us back to Roman doctrines of possession, but the way they used it, they didn't cite Roman law, they didn't cite particular author. You just assumed that by having possession for a certain time without contestation, one acquires the right to territory. So they assumed that if they have been using this territory for a certain period and nobody said to them they couldn't, then it meant that the territory was theirs. So I observed how these two things function together. And you can see that actors, as actors usually do, invoke what's best for them. So you see them invoking treaties, and sometimes it's treaty between countries, between the kings, but sometimes it's local treaties between municipalities or between military commanders in the Americas from both sides of the border. You see them invoking those when it's better for their cause, but you see them completely forgetting or silencing those when actual occupation and possession is better for their cause. But it seemed like they had both these ways of arguing and imagining their rights in their mind, and they could employ them alternatively.
Can you give a brief outline of what treaties and conflicts have been regarded historically as decisive in shaping these frontiers and how they worked alongside Roman law doctrines?
Well, so as mentioned, in the literature, at least for the case of the Americas, people constantly refer to the Treaty of Tordesillas, 1494, which is stereotypically told to have divided the world between Spain and Portugal, which is really an anachronistic reading, because what the treaty did is to design theoretically a line, but it wasn't very clear where it passed, between spheres of influence. Furthermore, when it was signed, it wasn't clear that it only divided the Atlantic or whether it also divided the Pacific. And it took a while before it was actually decided that it can also apply in the Pacific. But anyway, people refer to the Tordesillas as dividing, as I say, the world. But they also refer quite a lot to the Treaty of Madrid, 1750, which Spain and Portugal signed, dividing certain parts of the Americas between them. There were other treaties too, but somehow these treaties are very famous, to the Tordesillas, because it's considered to be the first treaty, which it wasn't. There were treaties before dividing territories between Spain and Portugal, but it becomes very famous, Tordesillas. And the Treaty of Madrid, because it was eventually annulled because it was impossible to implement in the Americas. In the case of the Iberian Peninsula, people mention Alcañices, 1297, which is a peace treaty between the kings in which they assign certain communities to the King of Portugal and certain communities to the King of Castile. The Treaty of Alcañices actually does not talk about territory, it talks about communities. So it doesn't identify which territory will become Portuguese or Spanish, it just says which communities will become, which means that in the aftermath, the territories of these communities had to be defined, which meant that it required an enormous amount of implementation and interpretation, Alcañices, which actually took centuries to do. Nonetheless, historians have said that this is how the border was fixed. And in the case of Spain and Portugal in Europe, there's a great insistence, often with pride, mostly among Portuguese historians, that because the border between Spain, well, Spain, Castile, and Portugal is 13th century, was made in the 13th century, this is the oldest border in Europe. That, of course, also gives Portuguese historians the legitimacy to say that Portugal has been recognized as an independent state since then. Again, historical rights to land, forgetting that there were periods in which this recognition was questioned and placed in doubt. But regardless, that's the story people have told. And what I've done in my own work, and more about the Americas than about the Spanish part, is actually to show how the treaties were really worthless, how the treaties required interpretation that was legal. What was meant, or the CS, for example, had determined that the line will pass a certain distance from a group of islands, but didn't determine where in the group of islands. So legally, the parties could not exist, whether it's the point of reference would be the center of the group of islands, the east or the west of the group of islands, the Azores and Cabo Verde. which of course would make a huge difference in terms of where the line passed. But the questions were not only legal interpretation, the question were also implementation on the ground. What does it mean to draw this line, most particularly in a period in which there were no trustworthy maps, there was no way to actually designate clearly where territories were. There was even a debate about how big the planet Earth was. In the case of Alcanithes, 13th century, of course, as I mentioned, the treaty mentions communities, not territories. So you had to actually interpret what it means territorially wise to add a certain community or to subtract a certain community to the state. But the treaties were also worthless, we know, simply because the conflict continues. The treaties do not solve these conflicts. On the contrary, they sometimes one has the feeling that they made the conflict much more complex, because besides the confrontation over what is mine and what is yours that already existed before the treaties, now you had the added question of how to interpret the treaties, what they meant to do, how to implement them. So there was really a sense, and it's quite amazing how historians have told the story about the treaties as fixing the boundaries, and then said that there was a debate about what it meant, and then that there was continuous war and disagreement, and nevertheless still insisted that the treaties determined the boundaries, despite all this conflict. And eventually we do know that in the Americas, the border ended up being vastly different than what any of the treaties determined. And actually in Spain and Portugal too, it's true that communities were not many, a few communities passed from Portugal to Spain or vice versa after the Treaty of Alcanithes. But more than communities passing, we do know that eventually the drawing of the boundary took 400, 500, 600 years to accomplish. And it's hard to judge whether changes were made or not in the process, because we have no idea what it meant in the beginning. It was a process of clarification. So clearly, we also know that change in the communities themselves, in the way they used the lands, was determinant to what it meant to include them or exclude them in the Iberian Peninsula. But treaties were so absurd. One of the examples I always give to how absurd they were, one of the treaties between Spain and Portugal is actually the Treaty of Utrecht in 1750, where they established the general norm that things which were acquired during the war should be returned once the peace is established. And then they name a few examples. And most of the examples that the treaty named are insignificant. There's a castle that is being named. There's a small island that is about 2 miles by 1 mile long. And, you know, one wonders how they got how they got included in the contract, in the treaty. But obviously, it goes to show that the treaty was, as I say, sometimes very, very, very absurd. So the treaties certainly were a framework that people were thinking about, as I mentioned before, but also treaties between communities that are less famous in the historical studies that we have, treaties among military commanders on the border, and I do mention those in the book too. But I think what I found much more interesting in that in all these debates, when people spoke about where the border should pass, which territory should belong to which community, they had a very clear sense of what made the land theirs. And that was really what I was looking for, to see why they thought the land was theirs, how come they had the right to it. And that's where this legal Roman law intervenes. But as I mentioned before, what is interesting is that these are not lawyers discussing. These are ordinary people on the border, very often, as I mentioned, illiterate, no legal experts accompanying them. Sometimes these are clerics, so friars, so they're maybe slightly more educated, but they have a very strong notion of what make the land theirs. And as I mentioned, I call it possession because they didn't really go into details that a lawyer would do regarding the different types of possession, and they didn't classify it the way that an erudite would, but they had a very clear sense that if they have been on the land doing whatever they were doing, using the land in a certain way, and none of their neighbors protested against it, it meant that the land was theirs. And that's constant everywhere, all the time, which I found was really interesting, not only because it was so widely shared, not only because it resonated so much with erudite legal doctrines, though I was sure they didn't read these doctrines, and then, of course, made me ask as a jurist how come they knew about it, but I have no answers for that. But it also was, to me, fascinating because it determined what they could do and what they couldn't do. So I describe in the book, for example, how it made them want to show that they used the land even when they didn't use the land. So sometimes they did ceremony of using the land just to make sure that they're showing to their neighbors that they're using their land. It made them react very, very strongly to whatever the neighbors were trying to do, because they were afraid that if the neighbors used the land, and sometimes it's just entry of one person to collect wood, and nobody really cared for the one person, and nobody really cared for the wood, the little wood that he or she collected. But they knew that if they didn't protest, this could be the grounds to claim that the territory belonged to a different community in the future. So it was really important to immediately protest against even the most ridiculous and minor activity by neighbors. So I really felt that this idea of rights by possession conditioned the dynamic on the frontier and explained a lot of things that before historians had failed to notice. For example, the use of violence. The use of violence, people always mention that these border conflicts, there was a lot of violence involved, whether it's violence against the animals, if somebody came in with their sheep to graze, sometimes the sheep would be apprehended, even taken away. There was, of course, beating, threats of violence, but sometimes even death, assassination and so forth, over as when neighbors did, or when people argued that their neighbors did what they shouldn't have done in the territory because they had no rights. And people have usually said this is very sensible. If you see your neighbor invading the fields of your community, you're going to react with violence. You're going to be angry. It's a spontaneous, natural response to the invasion by somebody who you think doesn't have rights to your land. But in fact, if you think about it as from the point of view of the theory of possession and how people justify their right to land, you understand that violence is actually a legitimate response, because according to this theory, if you saw your neighbors performing activity in your land and you said nothing, then your silence is understood as consent, as agreement. So if you let this one person go into, that belongs to another community, go into your territory and collect wood, and you said nothing, you consented. And therefore, by implication, you agreed that this person had rights to your territory. The only way to stop it would be to protest. So as I mentioned before, you protested against things that you really had no reason to protest or you really didn't care about, but it was really important to protest against. But the best protest was violence, because less violent protest could be perhaps misconstrued, misread, whereby if you go and you, I know it sounds horrible, but if you go and you hurt this person, if you take away their animals, if you kill them, it's quite clear and it's well known and everybody's going to know that you're opposing. So a lot of this violence was performative too. It was meant to demarcate borders. It was meant to make clear opposition. It wasn't just senseless. And actually, people speak about it in these terms. They explain why they engage in violence. And one of the things that, this is also returning to present day things. So I go a lot to Spain and Portugal, both in Europe and the Americas, but quite a lot in Europe. And one of the things that had happened recently because of the European Union, there's a lot of transfrontier collaboration and a lot of projects together. And I've been collecting, actually, I have quite a lot of material of these border communities in which from both sides of the ocean. So sorry, both sides of the border, in which they talk about how friendly they are, how their shared histories, how much, and the way they present it is really as if the communities on both sides of the border loved one another and always collaborated. It's the states and the horrible border that state imposed between them that made them quarrel. And they talk about the long history of marriage, of common markets, of worshiping together certain saints, pilgrimage, stuff like that, which I'm sure was true. And actually, I've seen in my research as well. But that doesn't mean they didn't confront over land. It's on the contrary. And in my own research, I found that the nearer communities were, and the more they collaborated, the more they were likely to engage in violence, because there was much more of a sense of closeness and danger. It's when your neighbors from the other side of the border are also friends that you need to tell them, yes, we're friends, but you cannot come into my territory and take my wood because this is my territory. So I'm looking at some of the cases, and in Europe, it's quite clear that it was this closeness and collaboration between communities that actually made them engage in a lot of violence and border fixing as well. I became kind of cynical about this reconstruction of past that forgets certain things anyway.
To what extent then could treaties actually solve territorial conflicts? For example, the Treaty of Tordesillas, was it an addition to the problem of territorial division or a solution to it?
Yeah, so my sense, it really did make the conflict much more difficult to resolve because it just added a layer of complexity. Not only would people now discuss who was in possession of which part, they would also have to discuss and what happens according to Tordesillas. And you see that they take Tordesillas wherever they want. So sometimes they say, if according to Tordesillas this is ours, then that's the end of the discussion. In other occasions, this is both Spaniards and Portuguese doing the same. In other occasions, they would say Tordesillas is just delineates the sphere of expansion. So you have to be within your rights according to Tordesillas and take possession of the land. Without taking possession of the land, it's not going to work. So what happens if you take possession of the land when it's not your territory according to Tordesillas? And then, of course, they ask, except for Tordesillas, there's, of course, the papal bull of the previous year that also so divides the territory between Spain and Portugal. So then they ask, so, and they're different, the line according to the bull and the line according to Tordesillas. So they start asking, so how come Tordesillas, which is a treaty between two kings, can modify what the Pope, which is supposed to be a higher authority, an international authority, had decided? So no, it resolves actually nothing. It's a point of reference to contemporaries, but it really doesn't get to solve anything. It just makes the conflict much worse, I think.
Territorial divisions by legal treaty or by scientific and geographic determination would seem to be rather remote from the realities of Portuguese and Spanish settlers in Europe, and even more so those residing in the borderlands in America. How did they view or interpret their rights of possession, and how did they cope with the threat of foreign intervention in their lands?
So as I mentioned, I think that for them, it was remote in the sense that it didn't really give them a clear sense of what their entitlements on the ground were. They knew, maybe some of them knew what the treaty said, but they didn't know what it meant in practice on the territory. They certainly experience the territory differently. They experience the territory not so much in terms of jurisdiction and belonging to state. They experience the territory as something you use. So they really weren't concerned so much with abstract border. They were concerned with how they can use the lands. That's really the question contemporary ask. Where can I take my goats? Where can I collect cacao in the Americas? Where can I convert Indians in the Americas? Where can I persecute criminals? When do I have to stop running after them because now I'm the territory of another power or another jurisdiction? So I think for the contemporaries, except maybe those who are in the courts and are seeing it from a bird's viewpoint, the question of which territory belonged to whom was interpreted really as the question of what they as individuals and communities can do in certain places and what they can't do, which also meant what they should allow their neighbors to do and when they had to protest. So as I mentioned in the book, one of the most difficult thing about this theory of possession that instructed you to protest if you thought that your neighbors are violating their rights is that you had to make a determination in each case, do they violate your rights? So again, to my example of the single individuals who goes into territory to collect a little bit of wood. So not only that you don't care that he comes in, not only that you don't care for the wood he collects, but you feel that you have to protest because you're afraid it might lead in the future to territorial claims. You have to decide whether you need to protest because the territory is yours. Because if you protest, you make a claim that the territory is yours and not theirs. But if you believe that maybe where he's collecting the wood is his territory, or maybe it's a territory that belongs to no one, then perhaps you don't have to protest. So the daily experience was not only the need to constantly see what your neighbors are doing, constantly to decide whether you have to protest or not, maybe employ violence. It involved the question, where can you go? And when, where will you be safe and where you might be attacked? And I think this is really the daily experience that people had. And more in the Americas than in Europe, or not only, also the sense that if they wanted this territory, they had to perform activities that showing it's theirs. So there's a certain competition over who's going to get there first and establish usage. So as I mentioned, it's true in Europe too, as communities start, for example, using the mountain ranges that they haven't done before because of cattle raising and stuff like that, they compete over who's going to use it first. But certainly in the Americas, you see different individuals trying to push as hard and as fast as possible in order to get to places before their rivals would, in order to establish their possession before somebody could protest. And in order to be in a position to be able to protest if somebody else comes after them. So I think that's the experience, the daily experience they had, not at all the kind of mega discussions about imaginary lines coined in European treaties.
How did advances in technology and scientific knowledge change perceptions of possession and ownership from the time of the Treaty of Tordesillas up to the 18th century?
So there is a constant, and this is true about Tordesillas as other treaties, there is a sense among some people that with the improvement in science and technology, it might be easier to solve these conflicts because this improvement might mean that we'll have better maps, so we will be better able to trace a real border between the countries. Improvement will also mean that once we agree on these borders, we could actually find out where they pass on the ground. We would be able to stand in a mountain, measure its exact location, and say, with respect to the map that we already have, it's Portuguese or Spanish. So there's a very strong sense about Tordesillas, which of course theoretically marks this abstract line on the map, but also about other treatises. You know, the Treaty of Madrid, 1750, one of the reasons it's annulled is because the expeditions that are sent to the America to demarcate it on the ground cannot agree on where it passes, because the maps that the treaty uses were completely wrong. They had no idea of what really was there on the territory, and because they didn't have enough scientific means to actually know when they were on the ground, where exactly they were with respect to this imaginary line that was drawn in the treaty. So they end up annulling the treaty, among other things, because they just can't make it real. So there is a whole faction within both Spain and Portugal that really believes that as science will improve and technology will become better and maps will be clearer, but we will also be able to know better where we are when we stand on the ground with respect to these maps, it will be possible to solve all the remaining issues. But there is a whole other faction that says no, There is a faction that says, no, it's not about science, it's about legal interpretation, because Tordesillas, for example, legally is really a mute point. It's a horrible treaty that doesn't explain where it has to pass, where the line would pass. But also because they think that possession is more important than treaties. So, but there is a faction that believes that time will heal these questions because science will improve.
As we mentioned in previous podcasts, the Spanish and Portuguese kingdoms were united under King Philip II of Spain in 1580. And a few years after Iberian Union, Pedro Ambrosio de Honderis, who was the chief cosmographer of the Council of the Indies, complained in 1593 that the Portuguese had not acted in good faith in their previous negotiations with the Spanish throughout the 16th century. Now that he had access to authentic Portuguese maps, which were being sent from Lisbon to Madrid and to Seville, he was able to claim that Portugal had purposely altered them in negotiations to bolster their territorial claims in Southeast Asia. Is there any sense that they did the same in their disputed regions in South America?
Completely. Actually, there is a very famous map, which is called Mapa das Cortes, made by the Portuguese, that, according to researchers, was deliberately modified and, in fact, was used in negotiation between the countries and did give Portugal advantages in this negotiation. So certainly there is a sense in which the parties would manipulate their knowledge. But I think we have more information about how the Portuguese have done that. Among other things, because in general, I find Portuguese records much more honest. They're less detailed. The Spaniards say much more than the Portuguese. I always tell this story. So in the Iberian Peninsula, I was looking at records of municipal councils on both sides of the border. So I would spend the morning here, the afternoon here. And on the Spanish side, I would find copies of the letters they wrote to the Portuguese, extended description of the debates in the council. And on the Portuguese side, I would find the following records. We met today. We discussed everything we needed to discuss. We read the letter we received. We took a decision. And I was like, are you kidding me? So, but the Portuguese are very honest, on the other hand. When they do write, they write things that I think Spaniards wouldn't write. So I think it's very clear that the Portuguese were manipulating knowledge. But I'm sure the Spaniards were too. But we have to remember that during this period, knowledge was also a secret. This is a period in which what we call scientific knowledge was really knowledge that was managed very often for the state and taking into account state interests. States often guarded this knowledge secret. They didn't want other states to have it. So it's quite normal that whatever knowledge they would have of the territory or of problems in the territory, whatever it is, they would keep to themselves and they would manipulate. I think it was almost part of the territory during this period. I don't know if science is neutral today. I have my doubts, but it certainly wasn't in the early modern period. Nobody pretended it was.
So in the second chapter of your book, you discuss the relationship with natives. Why speak about the indigenous people in a book that surveys a territorial conflict between two European powers?
Well, for me, speaking about natives was a means to point out that although the literature that studies the border really cares about the negotiation between Spain and Portugal, and if it treats native at all, it treats the relationship with natives as a different question. For me, these two questions were intimately connected. In order to establish their control over the Americas, in order to make claim to territory, both powers knew that they had to do something with the indigenous population. So from a contemporary point of view, dealing with natives was part of the way you dealt with foreign powers and vice versa. And that's very clear when you look at the documentation. So I'm very often shocked at this kind of narrative that described the indigenous as the internal, that you have, it's the internal border against internal people. whereby describing the conflict between Spain and Portugal as external against outside neighbors, when it's quite clear that what happens there is precisely the question of who's internal and who's external. And it's during this conflict between the two powers that certain Indians become internal and certain Indians become external. So I really wanted to link these two bodies of literature, the literature that deals in the relationship between Europeans among themselves and the literature dealing with the relationship between Europeans and natives together. Oddly, you know, I often accuse or criticize the literature on North America as not profiting enough from what historians have been doing about Spanish and Portuguese America. But there, on this question, I think the historiography of North America has advanced much more than the historiography of South and Central America, in the sense that I think the historiography of North America is much more conscious of the fact that there was a relationship that you cannot divide the relationship or separate the relationship between natives and Europeans from the relationship among Europeans. So that's what I wanted to show. It's also part of this understanding that I have that you cannot analyze control of a territory without thinking about control of the people, that the stereotype that we have from European literature that monarchs cared about personal subjection and then they started to territorialize their control is kind of odd, because even when you want to control territories, you know that you need to control the people and you need to classify the people as yours. So there's always a relationship between acquiring territory and acquiring control over people that cannot be really separated. In the case of the South American territory that I'm looking at, it's very clear to both the Spanish and the Portuguese that if they wanted to have right to land independently of treaties and possession, they needed to either integrate or to eliminate the indigenous, but they couldn't leave them as they were. And in fact, they engage in both. They try to integrate the Indians or they try to exterminate the Indians, depending on whether they think one policy is better than the other. I don't think there is a moral call there that they made clearly. I think they alternate between one policy or the other. They classify some natives as almost redeemable, in the sense that these are natives can be integrated and therefore should try to integrate. And they classify other natives as enemies that cannot be integrated and therefore have to be exterminated. And then they reclassify them again and think maybe now they can be integrated. So there's a constant dynamic relationship. But they're aware of the fact that if they do not control or get to some degree of understanding with natives, they will never have possession of the land.
And you describe the involvement of missionaries in the territorial conflict between Spain and Portugal too. Can you elaborate on this?
Yes, so missionaries was one of the ways in which Europeans sought to integrate the indigenous. And according to early modern doctrines, religious and civic conversion went together. So the missionaries that converted the indigenous into Christian also converted them theoretically into the subjects or vassals of the power that sent the missionaries there. So missionaries working for Spain, independently of whether they were foreigners or not, and very often the missionaries actually working in the Americas were Italian and German or Czech, what we would say today Czech. So they were not Spanish or Portuguese, but they were sent by the Spanish or the Portuguese state. And the idea was that once they converted the natives also became subjects of these states. As a result, missionaries were seen to be actors in the territorial conflict, because as they converted people, they also made them subjects of the crown. So they enabled the crown to control them, at least theoretically. They enabled the crown to acquire rights over these people. But missionaries were also actors, because by establishing missions, the states that sent them could argue that they established possession of the territory, because missions were settlements, they were enclaves, and that was a very good way to establish possession of the territory. So there's a constant sense by which missionaries, again, independently of what their identity was as persons, actually could act for the state, could acquire territories and people for the state. So they become extremely important in the territorial debate. And in the book, I actually look at especially Jesuits, but eventually from the Portuguese side, also the Carmelites who work in the Amazon, and showing how central they were to these territorial debates and how much they engaged in them. Because what is interesting is that, in a sense, these friars, these missionaries, because they wanted to convert natives, they had an interest too in knowing whether the territory belonged to Spain and Portugal, because the Jesuits sent by the Spanish monarch needed the territory to be Spanish in order to be able to reside on the territory and convert its natives. If the territory was Portuguese, then they needed license from the Portuguese king, which they didn't have. So in the end, you see these missionaries acting exactly in the same way that settlers would. Settlers want to, I don't know, go and collect cacao in the mountains. And in order to do so, they need to argue that these mountains belong to their community, Spain or Portugal. But they also know that as they're collecting cacao, they're establishing the usage rights of their communities, and therefore they're acquiring this land for the communities. The same thing happens with missionaries. They go out there, they establish contact with new indigenous groups. They sometimes establish mission towns. And as they're doing it on the one hand because they claim that these are territories in which they, as representatives of the Spanish or Portuguese state, can settle. But they also know that by settling there and converting the natives, they're acquiring these territories to Spain and Portugal. And they're interested parties. And I found plenty of debates in which these missionaries actually stand guard on the territories and engage in very long and arduous debates about why they're there and therefore in establishing the rights of either Spain or Portugal to the territory.
Now, you state that, quote, by the mid to late 18th century, religious control gave way to a new type of conversion that instead stressed indigenous political allegiance and acculturation, unquote. Can you talk about this evolution in relations with native populations and its implications for territorial claims?
Sure. So, you know, one of, again, the stereotypes we have on the in the literature on Portuguese and Spanish America, that there are not many treaties with native people, or if they are, they're not very important. And here again, I think one can take cues from the literature on North America that does and always have thought a great deal about treaties with native people. What I found amazing, and I really had no idea before I started investigating that, is how often treaties were made with native people in Spanish and Portuguese America. It's more common in the 18th century than in the 17th century, but it's there in the 17th century too. And I'm quite sure it's in the 16th century too, but we just don't have that much documentation. So you have a sense by which these European powers send missionaries because they think that conversion is a way to control people and to acquire territories. But they also engage in what we would call today civic understanding with these natives. And this is clearly something that is happening, as I say, in the 18th century. This is actually more common than establishment of missions, to be honest. And this understanding with natives, so people have called them treaties in literature on North America. There are very few books, but there are now a few books about them in South America, in Spanish South America. They call them treaties too. I don't know if it's treaties in the sense of formal, what we imagine be treaty, formal negotiation, formal documents. But you see these local settlers, local military commanders, sometimes the mediation of a friar actually or a missionary, talking to natives. In Portuguese, there's a special name for it. It's called praticas. In Spanish, there is no special name, but you see them constantly speaking to individuals they identify as native leaders. And again, there's a huge question whether these native leaders were truly leaders or they were just mediators that could speak better to Europeans. And Europeans designated them as leaders because it was easy for them. So there's processes of change within native communities and even ethnogenesis, but there's a lot of literature on that that I mention in my book, but it's not really what I do. But You have Europeans constantly speaking to natives and trying to figure out what they think, trying to convince them to be obedient, to cede land, to obey the king, to convert, to resettle, and native reacting yes or no. Sometimes these things are highly ceremonial. Sometimes they're even written down. There could be a notary present, but very often they're verbal, they're ephemeral, but they're constantly happening. We have more record again from Portuguese America than from Spanish America about it. But you do get a sense that it's constant, the attempt to get to an understanding with natives. So for Europeans, if they got native consent to their presence there, if they got native agreements to cede territory, it basically gave them rights to the territory. So there was a sense that either you converted the native, thus making them subjects of European power and got hold in the land in this way, or you got hold of the land because you got into an agreement with natives that ceded the land to you or agreed without conversion to become subjects.
And alliance making with Indigenous Americans could often be quite a ritualized business for both Spanish and Portuguese negotiators. Can you tell us a little bit about these processes?
Yes, yeah, so it's we have a few narratives, not that many, but we have wonderful narrative from Portuguese America of, and this is actually a 17th century of Padre Vieira, who's a very famous missionary in the Americas, making these elaborate ceremonies of alliances in which he mixes religion with alliance making. So there is a cross and they swear allegiance to the state in the presence of all these Christian symbols, and they do it in front of a friar, and then they sing a Te Deum, and then there is a cross erected. In Spanish America, we have more of a secularized type of events in which the natives who allegedly agreed to an understanding with Europeans are sent to the regional capital. They appear before the governor or the military commander. They maybe walk in a procession in town. They're accepted in the town council. They swear allegiance in front of audience. But you do have a sense that for both the Portuguese and the Spaniards, these are occasions for celebrations. And these are occasions that, to some degree or the other, should be public. And, of course, should be reported to the authorities because it's considered a great success. What I find very puzzling in these understandings with natives is really to understand or to gather what did natives think and what did it mean for natives. And I actually have a forthcoming article in which I try to imagine native law by looking at the way natives reacted. So trying to read through native activity what they thought these agreements meant, which is kind of reading on the inverse, from action to thought rather than from thought to action. But it's very hard to know what natives thought. What is quite clear in the records is that Europeans were predisposed to think that natives agreed. The Europeans who were in the Americas thought they had the right to be in the Americas. They really didn't. After the 16th century, they don't really question their right to be in the Americas. So they assume that natives are going to agree. And they're willing to read agreement into everything except violence. So here we are again back to the question of violence. So if natives act violently, like happened on border conflicts, Europeans agree perfectly well that they're not, they understand perfectly well that they're not in agreement. But as long as they're not overtly violent, Europeans think they consent. So you see very well the performative aspects of violence. So if natives say nothing, Europeans think they consent. If they are smiling, they think they consent. If they hug them, they think they consent. If they say something, they think they consent. They really have to kill the Europeans they're talking to, for the Europeans to understand natives don't consent. So there's a really interesting way in which, but for Europeans, of course, it's really important to show native consented, because according to European perceptions, you cannot arrive at an understanding without the other side agreeing, right? So the Europeans go to a very long, so both Spanish and Portuguese go to a very long narrative explaining how natives consented. But, you know, for a modern day observer like us looking at it said, what? I don't see consent there. But for them, it was consent, and it was really important for them to show native consent.
So turning briefly to Iberian Union again, how were conflicts or uncertainties over territorial claims in Europe and America affected by the union of the Portuguese and Spanish kingdoms from 1580 to 1640? And what happened after it ended?
So one thing that is clear, you know, there's a big debate about what happens during the union of the crowns and whether the union was only personal. Did it have any implications for the constitutional structure of both kingdoms? And I don't go much into that in my book because this is really a much larger issue. But what I do see on the ground that the union does is it makes things even more murkier, much more uncertain, whether Portugal remains with its own structure, laws, citizenship, colonies during the union, and none of these were affected by the union or not. Perhaps this was true legally. Perhaps legally Portugal remained separate during the union, but de facto on the ground, people didn't feel this way. On the ground, you see Portuguese actors acting in Spanish territories, Spanish actors acting in Portuguese territories, the authority of one side collaborating with the authorities of other side. Of course, despite all the nationalistic affirmations that people have done since, for actors during this period, it was not clear that Portugal and Spain would separate again. As far as they were concerned, you know, if you were looking in the 1580s and 1590s, you could imagine that this union would last forever. And you could imagine that there was no more a conflict between Spain and Portugal because there's no longer a Spain and a Portugal, but there's a united, even if composite, monarchy. So from the point of view of local actors, you see that there's a lot of murkiness and people don't really care as much. And then once the union ends, they start reinterpreting what had happened during the union. And of course, then they start saying, no, these were two different states. And of course, what was done by Portuguese belongs to Portugal. What was done by Spaniards belongs to Spaniards. But how do you distinguish one from the other is really hard when you have expeditions that are by people from both countries, when you have the authorities of both countries collaborated. And in the book, I'm actually looking at one very famous expedition that shows this complexity by a guy called Teixeira that traveled the Amazon just before actually the uprising or rebellion or independence of Portugal, call it whatever. And you see very well that in contemporary documentation, it is perfectly okay that the Portuguese comes to Quito, returns to Belém do Pará, that the expedition has both Spaniards and Portuguese. But then after the union ends, they start reinterpreting it and making claims, both the Spaniards and the Portuguese, on the basis of the expedition. And it's really hard to do, but they're trying their best. So my sense is that from the point of view of the territorial conflict between Spain and Portugal, what the union does is actually makes everything much more difficult. And people are aware of it in the aftermath of the union. And whenever they see lack of clarity, they say it all started in the union. Until the union, it was really clear. In the union, it was undetermined. And now it's really not clear. So they keep on, actually, local actors on the ground actually keep on pointing to the union as a time which introduces a lot of unclarity that's continued thereafter.
You seem to challenge the notion that these conflicts were among states. And you propose instead that there were mostly conflicts among individuals and communities who sometimes recruited the state to their quarrels and sometimes not. And you even argued that the king was mostly absent. Can you explain this?
Yes, from simply by studying the historical record of this border conflict, you see that the main actors are individuals that stand to lose or gain from the territory being divided in that way or the other. So the agents that actually promote these conflicts and demand the resolution as well, these are people who live on the territory, who want to use the land, who want to challenge what the neighbors are doing, who want to stay to make new claims. And they sometimes write to the king, ask for his support. They sometimes manage to recruit the king to their quarrels. In fact, more often in the Americas than in Europe, the typical reaction most of the time of the kings to what is happening on the, in the European border and on the, in the peninsula, is actually saying, these are insignificant conflicts among people. We don't care how they end, as long as they don't endanger the peace between the countries. So basically, they do not intervene in these local conflicts, except for saying you have to solve your differences. And if they see that locals cannot solve differences, they actually send judges to solve their differences. But these judges do not act as interested party. They act as judges. So the Spanish king would send a judge, the Portuguese king would send a judge, together they would meet in the border, and they would try to decide what are the rights of the parties. They would not try to negotiate a treaty between kings the way that eventually in the 19th and 20th century royal commissioners would try to do. In the Americas, the king tend to intervene more often because, of course, the America is much more huge. There's much more sense of a promise of riches, of mines, of people to convert, whatever it is. So the kings do have a sense that it's much more important. But even there, actors often find it hard to convince the kings to intervene, or at least to intervene more than by sending words. The typical intervention of kings, even in the Americas, is to say to local people, stand by your rights, defend your rights. But it's not sending people, it's not sending army, it's not, you know, or saying stand by your rights while we negotiate. But they do negotiate from time to time, but basically they expect the locals to do the job for them. But it is true that they do use what locals are doing in their negotiation with one another. So you have a sense, and I speak about it in the book very briefly, in which this relaciones de méritos, in which people send to the king narratives of how they conquered the territory and ask for rewards. We always think about them as these individuals fabricating these stories in order to gain favor with the king. But in fact, it's very clear that the king is happy to receive these narratives because these are the narratives the kings are going to use in order to make claim to the territory, them too. Because if their vassals conquered a certain territory, it means that they can argue that this territory is theirs too. So there's a way by which the pretension of individuals to reward from the king for what they've done in the America coincide with royal interest to show that the vassals had achieved certain things in the Americas. So the kings do not intervene often, more in the Americas than in Europe. It's really the actors on the ground who do most of the work for them. But the kings can use these activities of locals in order to negotiate between them. But really what the kings most want to ensure is that there is no war between the two countries. And that's the biggest insistence all the time, even about the Americas. It's kind of, it's almost like saying, stop fighting, kids, you know. We're tired. We as parents are tired of you fighting with one another. And very often you find the ambassadors in the court saying, let's not just do nothing. Maybe it will die of its own. If we don't react, maybe it will just go away. That's the most typical reaction. And when people press, I have this wonderful interview between this legendary Jesuit, Samuel Fritz, that comes to Lima to speak to the viceroy, and actually tells him what is happening on the ground, tells him that in the Amazon, the Jesuits have acquired a huge territory for Spain by establishing missions and converting, and now the Portuguese are invading it, and he needs help, he needs soldiers, he needs money. The viceroy actually tells him, it's wonderful what you're doing, but who cares, you know, who controls the territory? The Americas is huge, there's enough space for both Spaniards and Portuguese to expand in. The most important thing is, of course, to convert people. If you're already doing it, that's fine. He doesn't give him a cent. It's unbelievable, but he's so appreciative of what he does. So that's the typical reaction of the kings and the devils and the super egos.
Can I ask you about change over time? Your book sometimes covers conflicts that begin in the 13th century and continue right up to the 20th century, and in the Americas then from the 16th to the 19th century. Did the dynamics of conflict change over time?
Yeah, I think some changes did happen, though I think a lot of things also stayed the same. I have a sense overall that on the one hand, we already discussed the whole question of whether a better scientific knowledge, the accumulation of data, would enable to solve problems that contemporaries were not able to solve before. There's also a sense over time, of course, the more treaties you have, the more complex the legal questions are, and I discussed that briefly in the book too, that each subsequent treaty requires thinking about what was decided now in comparison and in conjuncture to what was decided before in the previous treaty. So actually the accumulation of treaties over time makes the legal interpretation much more difficult. But there is also a sense overall, and in the Americas, I also mentioned the beginning, the insertion of Indians is mainly through conversion. And then obviously we start also having understanding with Indians, that is through negotiation and alliance making and not just conversion. But in general, I also have a sense that the important changes in the way people think about the territory, and this is clearer to me in Europe than in the Americas, simply because the period I study in Europe is much more prolonged. So it's easier to see changes from the 13th to the 20th century than perhaps from the 16th to the late 18th or 19th century. In Europe, you see very well that in the beginning, most of the claims are just based on immutable rights, on customs. People talk about traditions, about acquired rights, though, of course, they disagree about what their acquired rights are. And, you know, if you look at it very closely, you see that all the things they call customs and immemorial, of course, very often are new and changing. But at least in terms of this discourse, they constantly refer to acquired rights to what happened in the past. But in a certain moment in the 18th century, they do start to talk about common sense and reason. They start talking about the fact that there are better places to have borders than others. They start talking about a certain rationalization of the space. There's also a clear sense in which they start to criticize the use of land for pasture and somehow suggest that cultivation, planting is a better use of the land. They start thinking that communal property is not as efficient, not as justifiable use of land as private property. So you see a move from this idea of communal property and pasturing and traditional rights to let's rationalize the use, let's make the use exclusive, let's ask who will use it better rather than who had it before. In Europe too, you see clearly the sense by which the states start being intolerant of murky situation in which communities along the border share territories that are neither Spanish nor Portuguese, or perhaps both, or the existence of communities that they call promiscuous because they include both Spaniards and Portuguese, the border sometimes passing inside the same house. The same house has a door here and a door there. And people are Portuguese or Spanish according to who they toast to in their wedding ceremony. So all these kind of situations which are unclear become intolerable in the eyes of 18th century and early 19th century administrators. And you see that there is a clear sense of intervention. So instead of respecting what has always been the case, what has always been the usage, saying that the past should continue, you start seeing a desire to rearrange things. And as I say, in the end, and it's noticeable in the Americas too, especially with regards to indigenous peoples, the claim that the land should be given to those who would use it better rather than to those who had it first, which is kind of exactly contrary to the discourse I began with about historical rights to land. This is really a period, the 18th and 19th century, where there is a great trust to eliminate the idea of historical right to land. And in the name of rationality and practicality and efficiency.
If these conflicts in the Americas and in Europe were so complex and conditional, when and how were they finally settled? And how important were these complicated localized disputes to establishing what was to eventually become the final borders between Portugal and Spain?
So, you know, there are eventually treaties among countries do become the norm in the 19th and 20th century, not so much before. And theoretically, all of them determine the border. But again, the little literature that exists on that says it's not that easy too. And one of the things that really amazed me as I was doing this research, there is a commission to determine the border between Spain and Portugal in Europe that is still working in the foreign ministry of both. And they're still dealing with problems of fixing the border between Spain and Portugal. And obviously in Latin America, we still have border wars. So now there are more water wars. They're more fighting over territorial water than the land. But as I mentioned, in 1995, there was a major war between Ecuador and Peru. There were conflicts still between Argentina and Chile. So a lot of these conflicts have not completely died. They kind of went underwater. But I think because precisely that sense of intervention, the sense of rationalization that I mentioned before, there is a moment in the 19th, 20th century when you privilege these kinds of consideration in which you are able to intervene on the territory and fix boundaries. There is something about historical rights to land that would never actually give you a clear answer. As long as communities make claims by looking at the past, it's really unresolvable, their differences, because the past was very long and there's always a question of which moment in the past. You know, if it's yesterday in the afternoon, it could be mine, but if it's 500 years ago, it was yours. And why would privileging yesterday afternoon more than privileging 500 years ago? And anyway, what happened 500 years ago, we might disagree, or we don't have information, or we interpret it differently to begin with. So the fantasy that looking to the past, to a certain status quo, would solve differences is a fantasy. And actually, you see that even in the early modern period. They always agree on return to the status quo. Nobody discusses the principle of returning to status quo. You just can't agree what the status quo was. And they could have completely conflicting narratives of what it was. So as long as the discourse was about historical rights, it had no solution in a sense. But once you started accepting other type of criteria, there was a window of opportunity to solve some of these conflicts, and some of them were resolved. But as I say, not all of them. And there are still pending problems. But of course, now that we're back to historical rights to land, well, now, for quite a while now, I think the murkiness comes in again. The question of precisely which moment is the moment in which we're going to look at the past and how are we going to find out what this past was and who had rights and whether we could agree on an interpretation is very problematic, I think.
And how does the analysis of what happens on one side of the ocean help in understanding the other? Did the experience of negotiating territory on one side affect negotiating on the other?
So I think it did, at least for me methodologically, as I mentioned, it allowed me to see different aspects of the same question of the right to land, just because as I mentioned before, the Americas were big. They were considered to harbor a great promise. The conflicts were much more chaotic, much quicker. When people spoke about possession in the Americas, it was 10 years, 20 years, 30 years long. It was fairly quick in historical terms. In Europe, it was smaller, much more dense, and much longer. Conflict took much longer. So these kind of different types of dynamics allows you to observe different things. I think contemporaries were aware of the relationship between one and the other. There are some clear instances in which they do. They realize that what they're doing in Europe might affect what they're doing elsewhere. And in fact, some of the treaties clearly mention it. The Treaty of Utrecht, for example, that I mentioned before, 1715, includes things about the America and about Europe, instructions about both. In times of war in the peninsula, they worry about the consequences of the war in the Americas and vice versa. So I think contemporaries had a sense that these things are connected. But beyond the question of whether Europe influenced the America or the Americas influenced Europe, I think the importance of studying them together is really that it allows us to see different aspects of the same question. I refer to it in my book as skewed mirrors. It's not exactly the same thing, and therefore you can highlight different dynamics.
You've noted that both the Portuguese and Spanish have long highlighted the fact that their border is, as you say, the most ancient in Europe. And they've consistently rejected the notion that they share a common Iberian trajectory. Why do you think there's been such a historical reluctance to acknowledge the interconnectedness of admittedly complex identities? Or is this just a romantic fantasy? Does the notion of Hispania actually exist, or has it ever existed?
So, you know, I think the problem generally with history is that it was founded, or at least modern history, it was founded as a discipline that was supposed to assist nation-building processes. And I know we now adore interconnected history and entangled history and global history, but in fact, a lot of the history is still done nationally. Sometimes because this is where the archives are, this is the linguistic competence that people, maybe they just feel that they know better about the local than other places. I often noted in my own work with some degree of cynicism that not only history is often done nationally, but all national histories present themselves as exceptional. And unique, and I often wonder if this is the case, what is the rule? But in the case of Spain and Portugal, most particularly, because they are neighbors, and I always think that neighbors tend to fight more than foreigners who don't know one another, because they share so much in common, I think there's a lot of stake politically in writing this history separately, most particularly, honestly, from the Portuguese side. I think for the Portuguese, it's very important to affirm that they were different than Spaniards, that they were always different than Spaniards, that they were always independent. There is a long tradition of portraying the period of union as foreign occupation, to which all Portuguese always resisted and resented. And I know you're going to speak to Pedro Caradim, so I'm already helping you publicize his interview too. But there's a group of historians among them, and a leader of this group is Pedro Caradim, but there are a few of them who actually have relooked. There's some also in Spain have relooked to the period of the Union to say, wait a second, that's not that simple. And I mentioned this literature in my book too, that really questions whether during the Union, and especially at the end of the Union, whether loyalties were national, the way they were portrayed before, assuming that all Portuguese wanted one thing and all Spaniards wanted one thing, another thing, or whether the breach was according to state, between nobles and commoners, according to where you lived on the territory, according to whether you were merchant or not, whether you thought that your interests would be served better by a unified structure or by a divided structure. So anyway, back to your question, I think there's a lot of stake politically in affirming the separateness of Spain and Portugal. But when you look at it from the outside, and perhaps this is my privilege as a real outsider, because I'm neither Spanish nor Portuguese, or at least I wasn't brought up, let's say. I wasn't brought up neither as a Spaniard nor as a Portuguese. That's a better description of who I am. I think it's quite clear to me that there's so many similarities. And the similarities are not just remote, they're not only early modern, even today. So, you know, one of the amazing things that it takes Spaniards forever to learn that the reconquest and the Muslim occupation and what is called the reconquest, the struggle against Muslim again, anachronistically presented as foreign invaders, it's not clear that they were, also happened in Portugal, right? But it goes on with the exploration, with the expansion, all the way to 20th century dictatorship and return to democracy. Napoleonic invasion, you know, there's very little literature on, in Portugal on the juntas, local juntas that were established and the guerrilla that took place. But obviously now we know it happened not only in Spain, that there were local juntas and guerrilla, but also in Portugal. So there's a lot of similarities that people haven't interrogated because of, I think, in general, historiographical emphasis on nation. But in the case of Spain and Portugal, because of their historical trajectory. So I personally think there is a place for an Iberian history that looks at both. And as I was doing this research, I didn't find that people were acting as Portuguese as Spaniards. I didn't find that they necessarily defined themselves as such. It depended. When it was good for them to do so, they did. But when it wasn't relevant, they didn't. So you clearly see that in the Iberian Peninsula, for example, they mostly struggled over municipal rights. So what was really important for them is to declare to which municipality they belonged, not to which quote-unquote nation or state. In the Americas, it depended. If it was relevant to be a vassal of one king or the other, that was the important category, but sometimes it wasn't. So I had a sense in which belonging to a monarchy or being a subject to a certain king could be really important or could be completely irrelevant to these people who were negotiated. And furthermore, there were no true differences between what they argued. There was, this is of course a period before the nationalization of law. Law was not a national thing. Usually, this is from my recent book on the history of European law, we tend to think about law national really with, about law as national from the French Revolution. So what we have in Iberia is very old Iberian law that was common to both countries. Then we have the penetration of Roman law that is pan-European with its local expressions. Then we have a decision made by the kings, which of course is not considered legislation, but is considered more like jurisprudence, the application of an existing law rather than the creation of law. So they don't have a sense in which they live under a different legal regime. They think that they can discuss their rights with one another because they understand one another. You see Portuguese litigants arguing their rights in Spanish courts, Spaniards arguing in Portuguese courts, never actually invoking the fact that this is a court in a foreign country. So you really see that for them, the question of being either Spanish or Portuguese could be mobilized and become really important on certain occasion, but not always. And as I was looking at these things, and because of my conviction that territory goes with people, I thought that this confrontation actually, in part between Spanish and Portuguese, actually in part sometimes made them think that it's irrelevant whether they are Spanish or Portuguese, but sometimes made this category much more salient. It really depended on the case. So I'm a great fan of Iberian history.
So we've talked mainly about Spanish and Portuguese conflict in Europe and America. Can your analysis be applied to conflicts between Spain and Portugal in Asia too, or to colonial conflicts of other European powers? Or was this a particular affair of these two powers and the Americas and Europe?
So yeah, my understanding is that what I say is probably true for other colonial conflicts during this period, as well as to the conflict between Spain and Portugal in Asia. That doesn't mean that the local circumstances would have not been different. The identity of actors might have been somewhat distinct. But I think the metrics of analysis would be the same. That is to say that all these contemporary actors both consider their understanding between communities, states, treaties, or whatever it is, but also had a very clear sense of what made the land theirs and how they acquire rights. That in all these cases, states and state agent had some agency, but it was mainly the local people on the ground that actually acted and enacted this and made it happen, and therefore were the main agents. I often say that looking at kings and courts is like looking at the tip of an iceberg, and I'm sure that in all these other places this was true too. Asia may have been slightly different because I think in many cases, European powers had a better appreciation of local sovereignties and local powers than they had in the America, depending. So they might have been more respectful of these foreign powers and their abilities to act. Though I think that also had its limits. I think it's like, for the American case, I often say it, when I look at the theoretical debates about indigenous right to land, I say there are all these wonderful debates and all these wonderful theories, but when you look at the way people act, they have Europeans act in the Americas, they really don't have any doubt that they have the right to do what they want and that their presence is legitimate and cannot be stopped, point. It reminds me of this saying in Spanish about, you know, if you know it, the Marqués de Santa Cruz, who built his, he was the admiral of the navy and he built his castle in La Mancha, which is really doesn't make sense. This is where the archives of the Spanish Marine are right now in La Mancha because of that. And there is a saying in Spanish saying, ¿Por qué lo hizo? Porque pudo y quiso. So why would he build a ridiculous palace in a ridiculous place? Because he wanted to. He could and he wanted to. So I think in the end, even for Asia, I would defend that they had much more respect and much more recognition. They knew they had to deal with, they knew they had to do treaties with. But I think for themselves, in their own eyes, they were more justified and perhaps and more sure of what they were doing than perhaps we give them credit to. But yes, I think this analysis is true. And in part for me, that book, Frontiers of Possession, is a way to dialogue, and I mentioned it a little bit before, with literature on North America, because I think at least with regards to territory, I think people who do Portuguese and Spanish Americas tend to learn a lot by reading that literature, though I don't agree with everything it does always, depending who, depending what. I think there are a lot of questions that were asked in that literature that historians of Spain and Portugal haven't been asking enough. In a certain moment, I used to call this book my Richard White book because I was at Stanford when I was writing this book and actually teaching and collaborating with Richard White, who kept on asking me questions about the relationship between the literature on Spain, Portugal, and in North America. So yes, I think we, the community of historians of Spain and Spanish America, Spanish America, Portugal, and Portuguese America stand to learn from speaking and dialoguing more with the literature of North America. I think they stand to do so too. So yes, I hope for a dialogue, and I do think it would apply, yes.
And do you think that the complicated history of Portuguese-Spanish border conflicts in America and in Iberia can somehow inform our wider understanding of how borders and identities are conceived and unmade, particularly in this uncertain current era of increasing nationalism, isolationism, external violations of sovereignty, and so on?
I certainly do. I think what part of the problem with current debates is they really assume permanence. There is something about all these debates that tend to present states as a given, communities as a given, as if they always existed in the same way. And obviously, as a historian, as I mentioned before, I think histories change over time, and I have a very strong sense of how much, how complex were the processes that led us to where we are, how much they were not foretold, almost accidental, how we could have gone different ways and the results would have been different. So I have a very strong sense of the longer trajectory in which neither states are given nor communities are given. And I wish we would remember that when we talk about current day states. You know, I live in the US, and of course, this is a major question. And for me, for example, one of the questions that the recent developments bring about is precisely when do immigrants, and this pertains more to my previous book, Defining Nations, when do immigrants become insiders enough to forget that they were immigrants once? And I describe this process in Defining Nations in Spain, when immigrants become so rooted in a community that they imagine themselves as natives. And this is very clearly happening in the U.S., where we know for a fact that everybody living in the U.S. are descendants of immigrants. And honestly, even Native Americans are. They just, you know, they arrived much earlier. But certainly the Africans are, because they were brought against their will, and those who are of European descent are certainly immigrants too. So when and by which processes have they come to imagine themselves as locals, as having more rights than other people? I think this is a fascinating process. How fast does it happen? What allows you to do that? But also just not just how the community is imagined, but also how territory is imagined. What makes you think that you have rights to a certain territory? There was a moment in the election in the U.S. in which, I don't remember now her name, an actress of Hispanic origin actually spoke about her family having resided in California for much longer than probably in most of people who identify themselves as Americans right now, because they've been there, you know, from the 17th century, 18th century, whatever it was. So thinking about that too, you know, how does this country come to acquire the territory it has, and why does it think it has rights to this territory? I think these are all really interesting questions. So I hope that just thinking about how complex and accidental these processes are would be the contribution of historians to a narrative that tends to simplify them, tend to think that they were, as I mentioned, foretold, that they were inevitable. There's nothing inevitable about the shape that present-day countries and communities have. And they have never been the same as they are right now. They constantly changed, whether we want to admit it or not. So I think that could be the contribution of history. And I think in my case, too, perhaps the belief that individuals matter, that in the end it's not countries that make history, it's individuals that make history. I have this huge argument with a lot of people whether leaders matter or not, and I'm sure they do on certain levels, but I think in the end it's individuals. We make history by doing what we're doing in everyday activities. It's not just, I dislike profoundly the idea that a historical event is this huge thing. I think we make history every day when we wake up and we do what we do. And certainly the people I was studying in the past, that's what they did. They acquired territories, they formed communities, not by big declarations and by major acts and wars. It was by letting their cattle pasture in a certain place and not allowing somebody else to do so. They might have not thought that they were making history, but when I look at it after 400, 500, 600 years, I know that they have. And they have because they insisted in doing it, and they've done it over a long period of time. So I don't know if this is an optimistic vision of history, but I would like to believe that it matters what we do in everyday life.
Tamara Herzog's book, Frontiers of Possession, Spain and Portugal in Europe and the Americas, is available from Harvard University Press. Professor Herzog, thank you very much.
You're welcome.